Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis, minister of the 12th Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount South of Charles Town, Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is February 26, 2017. Our date is 8/30/2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled, What a Friend We Have in Yahshua. What a friend we have in Yahshua, all our sins and griefs to bear, all privilege to carry, everything to Yah in prayer. Oh, what peace we often forfeit, oh, what needless pain we bear. Oh, because we do not carry everything to Yah in prayer. Every trials and temptation, is there trouble anywhere? We should never be discouraged. Take it to the Yah in prayer. And we find a friend so faithful, who will all our sorrows share. Yahshua knows our every week. Take it to the Yah in prayer. Are we weak and heavy laden, cumbered with the load of care? Precious Savior, still a refuge, take it to the Yah in prayer. Do the friends this cross forsake me, take it to the Yah in prayer. In his arms he'll take and shield me, and we'll find a soul to share. Part 22, Revival and Reformation, Patriarchs and Prophets. We're in this. Prophets and Kings. We're in chapter 51, a Spiritual Revival. Okay. Ezra's arrival in Jerusalem was opportune. There was great need of the influence of his presence. His coming brought courage and hope into the hearts of many who had long labored under the difficulty. Since the return of the first company of the exiles under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua, over 70 years before, much had been accomplished, for the temple had been finished and the walls of the city had been partially repaired, yet much remained undone. Among those who had returned unto Jerusalem in the former years, there were many who had remained true unto Yahweh and long as they lived. But a considerable number of the children and the children's children lost sight of the sacredness of the Yahweh's law. Even some of the men entrusted with the responsibilities were living in the open sin, for their course was largely neutralizing the efforts made by others to advance the cause of Yahweh. For so long as flagrant violations of the law were allowed to go unrebuked, the blessing of the heaven could not rest upon the people. It was in the province of Elohim that those who returned with Ezra had special seasons of the seeking of Yahweh, for the experiences through which they had just passed on their journey from the Babylon, unprotected as they had been by any human power, had taught them rich spiritual lessons. many had grown strong in the faith, and as these mingled with the discouraged and the indifferent in Jerusalem, their influence was a powerful factor in the reform soon afterwards instituted. On the fourth day after the arrival, the treasures of the silver and gold, with the vessels for the service of the sanctuary, were delivered by the treasurers into the hands of the temple officers in the presence of the witnesses and with the utmost exactitude. Every article was examined by the number and weight, and by the weight. Ezra 8:34. For the children of the captivity who had returned with the Ezra offered burnt offerings to the Elohim of Israel for a sin offering and as a token of their gratitude and thanksgiving for the protection of the holy angels during the journey. As they delivered the king's missions unto the king's lieutenants and unto the governors on this side of the river, and they furthered the people and the house of Elohim, verses 35 and 36. Very soon thereafter, a few of the chief men of Israel approached Ezra with a serious complaint. Some of the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites had so far disregarded the holy commands of the Yahweh as to marry with the surrounding peoples. They have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons. For the Ezra was told, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of the heathen land. Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers hath been chief in this trespass, Ezra 9:1-2. In his study of the causes leading unto the Babylonish captivity, Ezra had learned that Israel's apostasy was largely traceable unto their mingling with the heathen nations. He had seen that if they had obeyed Elohim's command to keep separate from the nations surrounding them, they would have been spared many sad and humiliating experiences. Now, when he learned that, notwithstanding the lessons of the past, men of the prominence had dared transgress the laws given as a safeguard against apostasy, his heart was stirred within him, for he thought of the Elohim's goodness and again giving his people a foothold in their native land. And he was overwhelmed with the righteous indignation and with the grief at their ingratitude. When I heard this thing, he says, I rent my garment and my mantle, and plucked off the hair of my head and of my beard, and sat down astonished. Then were assembled unto me every one that trembled at the words of Yahweh of Israel, because of the transgression of those that had been carried away, and I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice, verses 3 and 4. At the time of the Eden sacrifice, Ezra rose, and once more rending his garment and his mantle, he fell upon his knees and unburdened his soul in the supplication unto heaven. Spreading out his hands unto Yahweh, he exclaimed, O my Elohim, I am ashamed and blessed to lift up my face unto thee, my Elohim, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespasses grown up unto heaven. Since the days of our fathers, the supplant continued, have we been in a great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the land, unto the swords, and to the captivity, and unto a spoil, and unto confusion of the face, as it is this day. And now for a little space, grace hath been showed from the Yahweh, our Elohim, to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our Elohim may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For we were bondmen, yet our Elohim hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our Elohim, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And now, O our Elohim, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken the commandments which thou hast commanded thy servants the prophets, and after all that is come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that thou, our Elohim, hath punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and hath given us such deliverance as this, should we again break thy commandments and join in affinity with the people of these abominations? Wouldest not thou be angry with us still? Wouldest thou not be angry with us till thou hast consumed us, so that there should be no remnant for the escaping? O Yahweh Elohim of Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped as it is this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. Verse 6 through 15. For the sorrow of Ezra and his associates over the evils that had insidiously crept into the very heart of the Yahweh's work wrought recompense. Many of those who had sinned were deeply affected, for the people were very sore. Ezra 10:1. In a limited degree, they began to realize the heinousness of sin and the horror with which Elohim regards it. They saw the sacredness of the law spoken at Sinai, and many trembled at the thought of their transgression. One of those present, Shechaniah, by the name, acknowledged as true all the words spoken by the Ezra. We have transgressed against our Elohim, he confessed, and have taken strange wives of the people of the land. Yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this sentence. Shechaniah proposed that all who had transgressed should make a covenant with the Yahweh to forsake their sin and to be a judge according unto the law. Arise, he bade Ezra, for this matter belongeth unto thee. We also will be with thee. Be of good courage. Then arose Ezra and made the chief priests, the Levites, and all Israel to swear that they should do according unto this word. Verses 2 to 5. This was the beginning of a wonderful reformation with the infinite patience and tact, and with a careful consideration for the rights and welfare of every individual concerned. Ezra and his associates strove to lead the temperament of the Israel into the right way. Above all else, Ezra was a teacher of the law, and as he gave personal attention unto the examination of every case, he sought to impress the people with the holiness of this law and the blessing to be gained through the obedience. Wherever Ezra labored, there sprang up a revival in the study of the Holy Scriptures. Teachers were appointed to instruct the people. The law of Yahweh was exalted and made honorable. The books of the prophets were searched, and the passages foretelling the coming of the Messiah brought hope and comfort unto many a sad and weary heart. More than 2,000 years have passed since Ezra prepared his heart to seek the law of Yahweh and to do it. Ezra 7:10. Yet the lapse of the time has not lessened the influence of his pious example. Through the centuries, the record of his life of the consecration has inspired many with the determination to seek the law of Yahweh and to do it. Ezra's motives were high and holy, and all that he did, he was actuated by a deep love for the souls, for the compassion and tenderness that he revealed toward those who had sinned either willfully or through ignorance, should be an object lesson unto all who seek to bring about reform. For the servants of Yahweh are to be as firm as a rock where right principles are involved, and yet withal they are to manifest sympathy and forbearance. Like Ezra, they are the case transgressors, the way of life, by the inculcating principle that sit, that are the foundation of all right then. In this age of the world, when the Satan is seeking through the manifold agency to blind the eyes of the men and women to the binding claims of the law of Yahweh, there is need of men who can cause many to tremble at the commandment of our Elohim. Ezra 10:3. There is need of true reformers who will point transgressors unto the great lawgiver and teach them that the law of the Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. Psalms 9:7. There is need of men mighty in the scriptures, men whose every word and act exalts the statutes of the Yahweh, men who seek to strengthen faith. Teachers are needed. Oh, so much who will inspire hearts with the reverence and love for the scriptures. For the widespread iniquity prevailing today may in a great degree be attributed unto a failure to study and obey the scriptures. For when the word of Yahweh is set aside, its power to restrain the evil passions of the natural heart is rejected. Men sow unto the flesh, and of the flesh reap corruption. With the setting aside of the Bible has come a turning away from the Elohim's law. For the doctrine that men are released from the obedience unto the divine precept has weakened the force of the moral obligation and opened the floodgates of the iniquity upon the world. Lawlessness, dissipation, and corruption are sweeping in like an overwhelming flood. Everywhere are seen envy, evil, surmising, hypocrisy, estrangement, emulation, strife, betrayal of the sacred trust, indulgence of the lust. The whole system of the religious principles and doctrines, which should form the foundation and framework of the social life, seems to be a tottering mass ready to fall into ruin. In the last days of this earth's history, the voice that spoke from Sinai is still declaring, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Exodus 20 verse 3, "Men has set his will against the will of Yahweh, but he cannot silence the word of the command. For the human mind cannot evade its obligation unto a higher power. Theories and speculations may abound. Men say, try to set science in opposition unto revelation, and thus do away with Yahweh's law. The stronger and still stronger comes the command, thou shalt worship the Yahweh the Elohim, and him only shalt thou serve." Matthew 4:10. There is no such thing as weakening or strengthening the law of Yahweh. As it has been, so it is. It always has been and always will be. Holy, just, and good. Complete in itself. It cannot be repealed or changed. To honor or dishonor it is but the speech of man. Between the laws of man and the precepts of the Yahweh will come the last great conflict of the controversy between the truth and error. Upon this battle, we are now entering a battle not between the rival churches contending for the supremacy, but between the religion of the Bible and the religions of the fable and tradition. For the agencies which have united against the truth are now actively at work. For Yahweh's holy word, which has been handed down unto us at so great a cost of the suffering and bloodshed, is little valued. There are few who really accept it as the rule of life. Infidelity prevails to an alarming extent, not in the world only, but in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Many have come to deny doctrines which are the very pillars of the Christian faith. For the great facts of the creation as presented by the inspired writers, the fall of man, the atonement, the perpetuity of the law, these are practically rejected by a large share of the professedly Christian world. Thousands who pride themselves on their knowledge regard it as an evidence of weakness to place implicit confidence in the Bible and a proof of learning to travel at the Scriptures and to spiritualize and explain away their important truths. Okay. Christians should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise, and this preparation they should make by diligently studying the words of Elohim astern and striving for the conforming of their lives unto his precepts. For the tremendous issues of the eternity demand of us something besides an imaginary religion, a religion of the words and forms, which truth is kept in the outer court. Elohim calls for revival and a reformation, for the words of the Bible and the Bible alone should be heard from the pulpit. But the Bible has been robbed of its power, and the result is seen in a lowering of the tone of the spiritual life. In many sermons of the day, there is not that divine manifestation which awakens the conscience and brings life to the soul. The hearers cannot say, "Did not our heart burn within us while he walked with us by the way, and while he opened unto us the Scriptures?" Luke 24:32. There are many who are crying out for the living Elohim, longing for the divine presence. Let the word of Elohim speak unto the heart. Let those who have heard only tradition and human theory and maxims hear the voices of him who can renew the soul unto the eternal life. Great light shone forth from the patriarchs and prophets. Glorious things were spoken of the Zion, the city of Yahweh. Thus the Yahweh designed that the light shall shine forth through his followers today. If the saints of the Old Testament bore so bright a testimony of the Lordship, should not those upon whom is shining the accumulated light of the centuries bear a still more signal witness unto the power of the Elohim? For the glory of the prophecies sheds their light upon our pathway. Type has made an antitype. Now, V.T. Hallett talks about type and antitype in the death of the Yahweh's Son. For Yahshua has risen from the dead, proclaiming over the rent sepulcher, "I am the resurrection and the life." John 11:25. He has sent his Spirit into the world to bring all things unto our remembrance. By a miracle of the power, he has preserved his written word through the ages. For the reformers whose protest has given us the name of the Protestant felt that the Elohim had called them to give the light of the gospel unto the world, and in the effort to do this, they were ready to sacrifice their possession, their liberty, even life itself, in the face of the persecution and death. The gospel was proclaimed far and near, for the word of Yahweh was carried unto the people, and all classes, high and low, rich and poor, learned and ignorant, eagerly studied it for themselves. Are we in this last conflict of the great controversy as faithful to our trust as the early reformers were unto theirs? Blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, let the priests, the ministers of Yahweh, weep between the porch and the altar, and let them say, "Spare thy people, O Yahweh, and give not thine heritage to reproach. Turn ye even unto me with all your heart, and with fasting, and with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your heart, and not your garments, and turn unto the Yahweh your Elohim. For he is glorious and merciful, slow to anger, and of the great kindness, and repenting of the evil. Who knoweth if he will return and repent and leave a blessing behind him?" Well, that ends chapter 51. Our next chapter is chapter 52, A Man of the Opportunity. A man of the opportunity. Nehemiah, one of the Hebrew exiles, occupied a position of influence and honor in the Persian court. A cupbearer unto the king, he was admitted freely unto the royal presence. By the virtue of his position and because of his abilities and fidelity, he had become the monarch's friend and counselor. The recipient of the royal favor, however, though surrounded by the pomp and splendor, did not forget his Yahweh nor his people. With the deepest interest, his heart turned toward Jerusalem. His hopes and joys were bound up with her prosperity. Through this man prepared by his residence in the Persian court for the work under which he was to be called, Yahweh purposed to bring blessings unto his people in the land of their fathers. By the messengers from the Judea, the Hebrew patriot learned that the days of the trial had come unto Jerusalem as a chosen city. For the returned exiles were suffering affliction and reproach, for the temple and portions of the city had been rebuilt. But the work of the restoration was hindered, for the temple services were disturbed, and the people kept in constant alarm by the fact that the walls of the city were still largely in ruins. Overwhelmed with the sorrow, Nehemiah could neither eat nor drink. He wept and mourned certain days and fasted. In his grief he turned unto the divine helper. I prayed, he said, before the Elohim of heaven. Faithfully he made confession of his sins and the sins of his people. He pleaded that Yahweh would maintain the cause of Israel, restore their courage and strength, and help them to build up the waste places of the Judah. As the Nehemiah prayed, his faith and courage grew strong. His mouth was filled with the holy arguments. He pointed unto the dishonor that would be cast upon Elohim if his people, now that they had returned unto him, should be left in the weakness and oppression. And he urged Yahweh to bring to pass his promise. If you turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I gather them from thence, and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there. See Deuteronomy 4:29-31. For this promise had been given unto Israel through Moses before they had entered Canaan, and during the centuries it had stood unchanged. Yahweh's people had now returned unto him in repentance and faith, and his promise would not fail. Nehemiah had often poured out his soul in the behalf of his people, but now as he prayed, a holy purpose formed in his mind. He resolved that if he could obtain the consent of the king and the necessary aid in the procuring implements and material, he would himself undertake the task of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and restoring Israel's national strength. And he asked Yahweh to grant him favor in the sight of the king, that this plan might be carried out. Prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, he entreated, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. For months Nehemiah waited for a favorable opportunity to present his request unto the king. During this time, though his heart was heavy with the grief, he endeavored to bear himself with a cheerfulness in the royal presence. In those halls of the luxury and splendor, all must appear lighthearted and happy. Distress must not cast a shadow over the countenance of any attendant of the royalty. But in the Nehemiah seasons of the retirement concealed from the human sight, many were the prayers, the confessions, the tears heard and witnessed by the Elohim and angels. At length, the sorrow that burdened the patriot's our heart could no longer be concealed. Sleepless nights and care-filled days left their trace upon his countenance, for the king, jealous for his own safety, was accustomed to read countenances and to penetrate disguises, and he saw that some secret trouble was preying upon his cupbearer. "Why is our countenance sad?" he inquired. "Seeing thou art not sick, this is nothing else but sore of heart. For the question filled Nehemiah with apprehension. Would not the king be angry to hear that while outwardly engaged in his service, the courier's thoughts had been far away with his afflicted people? Would not the offender's life be forfeited? For his cherished plan for the restoring of the strength of the Jerusalem, was it about to be overthrown? Then he writes, I was very sore afraid. With the trembling lips and tearful eyes, he revealed the cause of his sorrow. Let the king live forever, he answered. Why should not my countenance be sad? When the city, the place of my father's sepulchers lies waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with the fire. For the recital of the condition of the Jerusalem awakened the sympathy of the monarch. Without arousing his prejudices, another question gave the opportunity for which Nehemiah had long waited. For what dost thou make request? But the man of Yahweh did not venture to reply till he had sought direction from one higher than Artaxerxes. He had a sacred trust to fulfill, in which he required help from the king, and he realized that much depended upon his presenting the matter in such a way as to win his approval and enlist his aid. I prayed, he said, unto the Elohim of heaven. In that brief prayer, Nehemiah pressed into the presence of the King of Kings and won unto his side a power that can turn hearts as the rivers of waters are turned. To pray, as the Nehemiah prayed in his hour of need, is a resource at the command of Christians under circumstances. When other forms of prayer may be impossible, toilers in the busy walks of life, crowded and almost overwhelmed with the perplexity, can send up a petition unto Elohim for the divine guidance. Travelers by sea and land, when threatened with some great danger, can thus commit themselves unto heaven's protection. In the times of sudden difficulty or peril, the heart may send up its cry for help unto one who cares. Unto one who has pledged himself to come to the aid of his faithful, believing ones whenever they call upon him. In every circumstance, under every condition, the soul weighed down with the grief and care or fiercely assailed by the temptation may find assurance, support, and succor in the unfailing love and power of a covenant-keeping Yahweh. Nehemiah, in that brief moment of the prayer unto the King of Kings, gathered courage to tell Artaxerxes of his desire to be released for a time from his duties at the court, and he asked for authority to build up the waste places of the Jerusalem and to make it once more a strong and defense city. Momentous results unto the Jewish nations hung upon this request, and Nehemiah declares, the king granted thee according unto the good hand of my Elohim upon me. Having secured the help he sought, Nehemiah with the prudence and forethought proceeded to make the arrangements necessary to ensure the success of the enterprise. He neglected no precaution that would attend to its accomplishment. Not even to his own countrymen did he reveal his purpose. While he knew that many would rejoice in his success, he feared that some, by the acts of the indirection, might arouse the jealousy of the enemies and perhaps bring about the defeat of the undertaking. For his request unto the king had been so favorably received that Nehemiah was encouraged to ask for still further assistance to give dignity and authority and to his mission, as well as to provide protection on the journey. He asked for and secured a military escort, for he obtained royal letters unto the governors of the provinces beyond the Euphrates, the territories with which he must pass on his way to Judea, and he obtained also a letter to the keeper of the king's forest in the mountains of Lebanon, directing him to furnish such timber as would be needed, that there might be no occasion for the complaint that he had exceeded his commission. Nehemiah was careful to have the authority and privileges accorded him clearly defined. This example of the wise forethought and resolute action should be a lesson unto all Christians. Yahweh's children are not only to pray in the faith, but to work with a diligent and provident care. They encounter many difficulties and often hinder the working of the providence in their behalf, because they regard prudence and painstaking effort as having little to do with religion. Nehemiah did not regard his duty done when he had wept and prayed before the Yahweh, for he united his petitions with the holy endeavor, putting forth earnest, prayerful efforts for the success of the enterprise in which he was engaged. Careful consideration and well-matured plans are as essential for the carrying forward of the sacred enterprises today as in the time of the rebuilding of the Jerusalem's wall. Nehemiah did not depend upon this uncertainty. For the means that he lacked, he solicited from those who were able to bestow, and Yahweh is still willing to move upon the hearts of those in the possession of his goods. In the behalf of the cause of truth, those who labor for him are to avail themselves of the help that he prompts men to give. These gifts may open ways by which the light of the truth shall go to many benighted lands, for the donors may have no faith in Yahshua, no acquaintance with his word, but their gifts are not on this account to be refused. The builders on the wall. Chapter 53. Nehemiah's journey unto Jerusalem was accomplished in the safety, for the royal letters unto the governors of the provinces along his route secured him honorable reception and prompt assistance. No enemy dared molest the official who was guarded by the power of the Persian king and treated with the marked consideration by the provincial rulers. His arrival in Jerusalem, however, with a military escort showing that he had come on some important mission, excited the jealousy of the heathen tribes living near the city, who had so often indulged their enmity against the Jews by the heaping upon them injury and insult. Foremost in this evil work were the certain chiefs of these tribes, Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian. From the first, these leaders watched with the critical eyes the movements of the Nehemiah and endeavored by every means in their power to thwart his plans and hinder his work. This is what Obama's doing today with Donald Trump. He represents these Muslim Arabs that are looking with a critical eyes the movement of Donald Trump on every move, to do the same thing that these guys did. Nehemiah continued to exercise the same caution and prudence that had hitherto marked his course. Knowing that bitter and determined enemies stood ready to oppose him, he concealed the nature of his mission from them until a study of the situation should enable him to form his plans. Thus he hoped to secure the cooperation of the people and set them at work before the opposition of his enemies should be aroused. choosing a few men whom he knew to be worthy of the confidence, Nehemiah told them of the circumstances that had led him to come to Jerusalem, for the object that he wished to accomplish and the plans he proposed to follow. Their interest in his undertaking was at once enlisted and their assistance secured. On the third night after his arrival, Nehemiah rose at midnight and with a few trusted companions went out to view for himself the desolation of Jerusalem. Mounted on his mule, he passed from one part of the city unto another, surveying the broken down walls and gates of the city of his fathers. Painful reflections filled the mind of the Jewish patriarch. As with sorrow-stricken heart, he gazed upon the ruined defenses of his beloved Jerusalem. Memories of the Israel's past greatness stood out in the sharp contrast with the evidences of her humiliation. In the secrecy and silence, Nehemiah completed his circuit of the wall. For the rulers knew not whither I went, he declares, or what I did. Neither had I as yet told it unto the Jews, or unto the priests, nor unto the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor unto the rest that did the work. For the remainder of the night he spent in prayer, for he knew that the morning would call for earnest effort to arouse and unite his dispirited and divided countrymen. Nehemiah bore a royal commission requiring the inhabitants to cooperate with him in the rebuilding of the walls of the city. But he did not depend upon the exercise of the authority. He sought rather to gain the confidence and sympathy of the people, knowing that a union of the hearts as well as of the hands was essential in the great work before him. When on the morrow he called the people together, he presented such arguments as were calculated to arouse their dormant energies and unite their scattered numbers. Nehemiah's hearers did not know, neither did he tell them of his midnight circuit of the night before. But the fact that he had made this circuit contributed greatly unto his success, for he was able to speak of the condition of the city with an accuracy and a minuteness that astonished his hearers. The impression made upon him as he looked upon the weakness and degradation of Jerusalem gave earnestness and power unto his word. Nehemiah presented before the people their reproach among the heathen. Their religion dishonored their Elohim and blasphemed. He told them that in a distant land he had heard of their affliction, that he had entreated the favor of the heaven in their behalf, and that as he was praying, he had determined to ask permission from the king to come to their assistance. He had asked Elohim that the king might not only grant this permission, but might also invest him with the authority and give him the help needed for the work, and his prayer had been answered in such a way as to show that the plan was of Yahweh. All this he related, and then having shown that he was sustained by the combined authority of Yahweh of the Israel and the Persian king, Nehemiah asked the people directly whether they would take advantage of this opportunity and arise and build the wall. The appeal went straight to their hearts. The thought of how heaven's favor had been manifested toward them put their fears to shame. And with the new courage, they said with one voice, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for this good work. Nehemiah's whole soul was in the enterprise he had undertaken. His hope, his energy, his enthusiasm, his determination were contagious. Inspiring others with the same high courage and lofty purpose, each man became a Nehemiah in his turn and helped to make stronger the heart and hand of his neighbor. When the enemies of Israel heard what the Jews were hoping to accomplish, they left them to scorn, saying, "What is this thing that we do? Will you rebel against the king?" But Nehemiah answered, "The Elohim of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build but ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. Among the first to catch Nehemiah's spirit of zeal and earnestness were the priests. Because of their influential position, these men could do much to advance or hinder the work, and their ready cooperation at the very outset contributed not a little unto its success. For the majority of the princes and rulers of Israel came up nobly unto their duty, and these faithful men have honorable mention in the book of the Yahweh. For there were a few, the Tekoites and nobles, who put not their necks to the work of their Yahweh. The memory of these slothful servants is branded with the shame, and has been handed down as a warning unto all future generations. In every religious movement, there are some who, while they cannot deny that the cause is Elohim, still hold themselves aloof, refusing to make any effort to help. It were well for such ones to remember the record kept on high, that the book, in which there are no omissions, no mistakes, and out of which they will be judged, their every neglected opportunity to do service for Yahweh is recorded. And there, unto every deed of the faith and love is held in the everlasting remembrance. Against the inspiring influence of the Nehemiah's presence, the example of the Tekoite nobles had little weight, for the people in general were animated by the patriotism and zeal. Men of the ability and influence organized the various classes of the citizens into companies, each leader making himself responsible for the erection of a certain part of the wall. And of some it is written that they built it every one over against his house. Nor did Nehemiah's energy abate now that the work was actually begun. With the tallest vigilance, he superintended the building, directing the workmen, noting the entrances and providing for the emergencies along the whole extent. About 3 miles of the wall, his influence was constantly felt. With the timely words, he encouraged the faithful, aroused the laggard, and approved the diligent. And ever he watched the movements of their enemies, who from time to time collected at a distance and engaged in a conversation as if plotting mischief, and then joined nearer the workmen, attempted to divert their attention. In his many activities, Nehemiah did not forget the source of his strength. His heart was constantly uplifted unto Elohim, the great overseer of all, the Elohim of heaven, his strength. He will prosper us. And the words echoed and re-echoed thrilled the hearts of all the workers on the wall. But the restoration of the defenses of the Jerusalem did not go forward unhindered. Satan was working to stir up the opposition and bring a discouragement. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Gershom, his principal agents in this movement, now set themselves to hinder the work of the rebuilding. They endeavored to cause division among the workmen. They ridiculed the efforts of the builders, declaring the enterprise an impossibility and predicting failure. What do these feeble Jews, exclaimed Sanballat mockingly, will they fortify themselves? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Tobiah, still more contemptuous, added, even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. For the builders were soon beset by the more active opposition. They were compelled to guard continually against the plots of their adversaries, who, professing friendliness, sought in the various ways to cause confusion and perplexity and to arouse distress. They endeavored to destroy the courage of the Jews. They formed conspiracies to draw Nehemiah into their toils, and false-hearted Jews were found ready to aid the treacherous undertaking, for the report was spread that the Nehemiah was plotting against the Persian monarch, intending to exalt himself as a king over Israel, and that all who aided him were traitors. But Nehemiah continued to look unto Elihu for the guidance and support, and the people had a mind to work. For the enterprise went forward until the gaps were filled and the entire wall built up to half its intended height. As the enemies of Israel saw how unavailing were their efforts, they were filled with a rage. Hitherto they had not dared to employ violent measures, for they knew that the Nehemiah and his companions were acting under the king's commission, and they feared that active opposition against him might bring upon them the monarch's displeasure. But now, in their anger, they themselves became guilty of the crime of which they had accused Nehemiah. Assembling for counsel, they conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem. Isn't that what's going on today with our government here and in Israel? Jerusalem, Washington, D.C., Donald Trump, Obama, Netanyahu, and all those Abbas and all those Palestinians and all those Muslims surrounded them. Same thing. At the same time that the Samaritans were plotting against Nehemiah and his work, some of the leading men among the Jews, becoming disaffected, sought to discourage him by exaggerating the difficulties attending the enterprise. For the strength of the bearers of the burden is decayed, they said, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build a wall. The discouragement came from still another source. For the Jews which dwelt by, those who were taking no part in the work, gathered up the statements and reports of their enemies and used these to weaken courage and create disaffection. But taunts and ridicule, opposition and threats seemed only to inspire Nehemiah with the firmer determination and to arouse him unto the greater watchfulness. For he recognized the dangers that must be met in this warfare with their enemies, but his courage was undaunted. We made our prayer unto our Elohim, he declares, and set a watch against them, day and night. Therefore sit I in the lower places behind the wall, and on the higher places I even sit the people after their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles, and unto the rulers, and unto the rest of the people, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Yahweh which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. And it came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and Yahweh had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us unto the wall, every one unto his work. And it came to pass from that time forth that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the habergeon. They which builded on the wall, and they that bear burdens with those that laded every one with one of his hands, wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword girded by his side, and so builded. Besides Nehemiah stood a trumpeter, and on the different parts of the wall were stationed priests bearing the sacred trumpet. The people were scattered in their labors, but on the approach of the danger at any point, a signal was given for them to repair thither without delay. So we labored in the work, Nehemiah says, and half of them held their spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. Those who had been living in the towns and villages outside Jerusalem were now required to lodge within the walls, both to guard the work and to be ready for the duty in the morning. This would prevent unnecessary delay and would cut off the opportunity that the enemy would otherwise improve of attacking the workmen as they went to go. And from their houses, Nehemiah and his companions did not shrink from hardship or trying service, neither by day nor night, not even during the short time given to sleep, did they put off their clothing or lay aside their armor. For the opposition, discouragement that the builders in the Nehemiah's day met from open enemies and pretended friends is typical of the experience that Those today will have who work for Yahweh. Christians are tried not only by the anger, contempt, and cruelty of the enemies, but by the indolence, inconsistency, lukewarmness, and treachery of the avowed friends and helpers. Derision and reproach are hurled at them, and the same enemy that leads to contempt at a favorable opportunity uses more cruel and violent measures. Satan takes advantage of every unconsecrated element for the accomplishment of his purposes among those who profess to be the supporters of Elohim's cause. There are those who unite with his enemies and thus lay his cause open unto the attacks of his bitterest foes. Even some who desire the work of the Elohim to prosper will ye weaken the hands of his servants by the hearing, reporting, and half-believing the slanderous boasts and menaces of his adversaries. Satan works with a marvelous success through his agents, and all who yield unto their influence are subject unto a bewitching power that destroys the wisdom of the wise and the understanding of the prudent. But like the Nehemiah, Elohim's people are neither to fear nor to despise their enemies. Putting their trust in Yahweh, they are to go steadily forward during his work with the unselfishness and committing unto his providence the cause for which they stand. Amidst great discouragement, Nehemiah made Elohim his trust, his sure defense, and he who was the support of his servants then has been the dependence of his people in every age. In every crisis, his people may confidently declare, if Elohim be for us, who can be against us? Romans 8:31. However craftily the plots of Satan and his agents may be laid, Elohim can detect them and bring to naught all their counsels. For the response of the faith today will be the response made by the Nehemiah, or Elohim shall fight for us, for Yahweh is in the work, and no man can prevent its ultimate success. Well, this brings the end of chapter 53, and it also brings the end of our study for this hour. We're going to contact us at the 11th hour call. That's number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close this service now with a song. Dusty Roads and Sandal Feet by the Elijah Dean.
I have reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for he walked those dusty roads and he loved me. Often frustrated, don't carry his burden all alone as he journeyed along the road to Calvary. Dusty roads and sandal. Oh, the journey was complete from the manger to the cross, to the golden streets, to the place in the land where someday we all shall meet. The altar of the story, dusty road, sandal feet. I have reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for there is nothing. Water and the wine, cast out demons, heal the blind, and this way I believe in the man of Galilee. Dusty roads are his companion, desert places his abode, sandal feet are often weary and they need the heavy load. Desperate complaining as he went along his way. Like Jonah.